Air Theory nerds. Welcome to Whiskey and International Relations Theory, where Patrick Jackson and I riff on a relevant book or article for really more time than is probably healthy. This is episode 2, and it's also part 2 of our blow-by-blow of Kenneth Waltz's classic, Theory of International Politics. Before we get started, I've got some podcast news and notes. The first is that you can reach me and Patrick via Twitter. My handle is at DHNexon, and his is at ProfPTJ. The podcast also has its own email address. That's whiskeyindigoromeo@gmail.com. It's also the case that you can now subscribe to the podcast via Apple and Spotify. That's new, so yay us. Our music is performed by Lyra Gemmell-Nexon, and the whole podcast is modeled after the Far Superior Game Studies Study Buddies, which you should go subscribe to. You won't regret it. I was recently on Van Jackson's Undiplomatic podcast. If you want to hear what a well-produced IR podcast sounds like, you should go check his out. Oh, right. Before I forget, there's going to be a point in this podcast where the audio suddenly changes over, basically where I delete some stuff and I recorded alternative audio over it. It'll be very obvious when we get to it, and it's kind of embarrassing, so I'll leave it as a surprise. Finally, Amazon thinks my new co-authored book, Exit from Hegemony, The Unraveling of the American Global Order, ooh, that sounds ominous, is coming out on Kindle on February 28th. So, you know, if you are so inclined, go buy a copy. I'd appreciate it. So then, anarchic orders and balance of power, this is chapter 6. This is where he just kind of lays out, right, how it is that anarchy inclines states to be concerned about relative power.
And he has the best argument I can think of for why it makes sense theoretically to only have anarchy and hierarchy and not endlessly proliferate types on page 115, 116.
Yeah.
You know, he ends up saying on the top of 116, you know, all categories have borders, and if we have any categories at all, we have borderline cases. Clarity of concepts does not eliminate difficulty of classification. Yeah. That's one of those moments where I'm kind of like, yes, this is exactly right. If you're going to define the structure of the system in such spare terms, endlessly proliferating categories about types doesn't make any sense. Obviously, no system is a pure anarchy and no system is a pure hierarchy. Mm-hmm. They're all mixed. But what's interesting is what is logically the case in the particular type, and then you can see how it gets mixed in practice in particular cases. So that's a moment where I think he's very, very clear about what he's doing.
Yeah, so he has this section on the virtues of anarchy. So so this is where he kind of lays out that, you know, he brings together anarchy, you know, it's that whole story we told at the beginning. Anarchy makes the units in anarchy, whatever they are. This can happen in domestic politics and civil wars, attuned to changes in relative power, because changes in relative power potentially threaten their security.
Right. And even if they don't realize that that's what they should be attuned to, they're going to end up getting selected out of the system if they don't become attuned to it. So there's a kind of evolutionary socialization
logic. And again, I don't know, but we may, because I'm not going to actually find it here. I've got it marked somewhere in the book, but he actually says at one point he does not mean that states actually die. State death is really rare. What he really means is they lose their political autonomy. Being selected out of the system just means not being a relevant great power. To be crude about it, Costa Rica is selected out of the system for Waltz, right? In the sense that it can never hope to be a great power, right?
Oh, no, he's absolutely clear. He says many times throughout the book, you have to write the history, or you have to write an account of international politics in terms of the great powers. Mm-hmm. You don't write it in terms of Micronesia or whatever.
So there's a lot of stuff here about, he's running this distinction further between national systems and international systems, and he's qualifying it a lot, actually. Mm-hmm. And he's, you know, saying, look, I don't mean that there's never violence in domestic systems, and I certainly don't mean there's no order in international systems. But there is something about anarchy, as I said, that makes states attenuated to relative power, or creates structural dispositions for them to be concerned about relative power, particularly relative military capabilities. And this kind of inclines a realpolitik approach, which he talks about on page 117. Mm-hmm. And then he has some stuff to say about fusions and balance of power theory, which essentially come down to the idea that balance of power theory, I mean, essentially what it comes down to is that balances of power can be understood as either intended or unintended outcomes of these pressures to care about relative power and ensure your own security. That you don't need something like a balancer, a deliberate, some actor doesn't have to deliberately balance power for this to happen. Right. They certainly don't have to be thinking about overall system-wide balances, right? You know, like supposedly the Congress system of the 19th century does. They just have to be thinking about their own security, and you will eventually get to behavior that will approximate balancing behavior or produce a balancing equilibrium, right, whether or not they intend to. And he's very explicit about that in places like 119 and stuff like that. And then he, in part three, you know, we're back to structural theories are plausible if we see sort of patterns over time when there's a lot of unit level variation, right? So it can't be the unit level variation that is explaining those patterns if they're the same.
He's also very clear. Once again,
yeah, this is actually pretty interesting methodologically.
It's also very clear once again that sort of that both on what the expectations of the theory are, and then what you're supposed to do with those expectations. So the expectations of the theory, clearly on 124, right, balances of power recurrently form, and states tend to emulate the successful policies of others. So those are the expected behavioral signs that the theory should be actually producing, right? That should produce recurrent balances, and it should reduce, should produce these patterns of emulation, which is interesting because it's all done at the aggregate level. So it's not, this is not a theory, it's very clearly not a theory of individual states doing individual things, and could not therefore be tested by looking at the behavior of individual states. The problem is then all the pieces of evidence that he produces in support of it are the individual doing of individual states. You know, there are some, next page.
Remember, careful judgment is needed.
That's right, careful judgment. Careful judgment is needed. That's right. Wasn't that point six or seven or something?
It's on 125.
125, yes.
But he actually, interestingly enough, says, you know, do not, we can't just use friction to explain delays in balancing. What he actually says here is that we need to use what we would now call causal process observation evidence, right? Which is weird.
Which is weird, because if it's really the case that what a systems theory does is explain recurrent outcomes without reference to the motivations and internal dispositions of the units, then I'm not quite sure what causal process evidence would actually give us about this, and why would it matter if a particular set of deliberations or set of policies followed along the lines that the theory would predict. So that's a little strange. With the example that he gives on the middle of 125, when he talks about the recurrence of balancing in bipolar systems in particular, he says, you know, look for instances of states making internal efforts to strengthen themselves, however distasteful or difficult such efforts might be. The United States and the Soviet Union following World War II, the United States by rearming, despite having demonstrated a strong wish not to, by dismantling the most powerful military machine the U.S. had ever the world had ever known, Soviet Union by maintaining men in arms, so on and so forth. The next sentence, though, the next paragraph, these examples tend to confirm the theory, which is the moment where if you have any kind of philosophy of science consistency with what had been said earlier in the book, you know, this is where the this is where your alarm bells start going off, because the idea that you can confirm a theory is something that Waltz is perfectly fine with. He's fine that you can find confirmatory examples, though most of the people that he drew on in the philosophy of science part of the book would argue that you can't actually confirm theories, you can only falsify them. But Waltz, throughout the book, is going to provide primarily confirmatory evidence. Examples of where we see states behaving, especially states behaving against their will, in line with the ways that the structural pressures of the system in Waltz's theory should incline them to behave. So there is a very strange way in which the theory, which he's already admitted, the theory highlights certain things, and the theory calls attention to certain things. So it's like calling attention to those things and then providing evidence that those things are there because your attention's been called to them is now confirmation of the theory. So there's a very strange little methodological slippage here.
Okay. So the other kind of highlight of this chapter, this is the kind of the use value stuff in the chapter that gets invoked a lot, is this is where he talks about balancing versus bandwagoning, right? Balancing is when you, well, balancing is actually kind of hard to define, right? I mean, just roughly for Waltz, balancing comes in two forms, internal and external. Internal is, you know, I fear somebody else's rising power as a state,
because states, I'm a state now, right? Hi, I'm a state. And so I build up my own military capabilities to offset that gap. Mm-hmm. External balancing is the formation of alliances. So what I do is I say, hey, you over there, if we kind of pull our resources for a while, we can block that person, that other state from conquering us, as opposed to bandwagoning, which is, you know, basically siding with the stronger side here. That's all he defines it. There'll be a bunch of literature down the pike that revisits these issues about how do we understand balancing and bandwagoning. Maybe we'll read some of that. But that's, and then, you know, he makes this kind of point that balancing should predominate in the international system. And is this where he says, you know, if bandwagoning predominated, we'd see a world hegemony rather than an anarchy? Is that here?
Is that point there? Or is that maybe one of the later chapters?
Maybe later. As we get like an hour and 20 minutes into it, there's a lot of redundancy here. But he does also. So that's the first point. The second point is that he does make clear that this is not, so. There's a debate between so-called defensive and offensive realists, and the way that this is sometimes characterized is defensive realists think that states pursue security, and offensive realists think that states, really, we're talking about great powers, maximize power. They like seek universal domination. And sometimes Gilpin is associated with offensive realism. Mm-hmm. John Mearsheimer self-describes as an offensive realist. But the thing is that...
Bottom of 126. Okay,
right. So, yeah. But the thing is here that for Waltz, while the system does incline you to seek security, it allows for power maximization, mm-hmm. right? So states can pursue universal domination in the system. It's just not a very good idea. Right, because then you provoke balancing coalitions and it's self-defeating. And if there's a policy recommendation of this book, and we'll see some of them later, it's don't go crazy and invade lots of places and try to maximize your power, because that's going to fail. Mm-hmm. And it's going to ultimately undermine your security.
Right.
Now,
the quote Dan was looking for earlier is on the bottom of page 126. Mm-hmm. If states wish to maximize power, they would join the stronger side, and we would see not balances forming, but a world hegemony formed. Mm-hmm. So if there was a world in which bandwagoning was the dominant strategy, then what you would get is hegemony. Yeah.
The first concern of states, and this is where we get into trouble, the first concern, but not the only concern of states, is not to maximize power, but to maintain their position in the system. Mm-hmm. Now, this does raise problems. If the system actually socializes really well, if it has these effects, we do get into the trap of why wouldn't everybody seek security? And if everybody seeks security, then how do you then get balancing? This is the Schreller critique. But, you know, honestly, you know, this is where you get into, there's all this variation at the kind of unit level and agents, and you get leaders who are really aggressive. You know, the system, domestic systems toss up, you know, Trumps and Bushes and
Boris's.
Well, is he trying to maximize? Brexit is not a way of maximizing international power, that's for sure. So there is this kind of broader issue about when we move into the question of what are leaders actually about, what they're actually about, their own political survival, mm-hmm. then this, for Waltz, that would just be kind of noise that mm-hmm. affects unit-level foreign policy, but that actually could change some of the ways he articulates, that actually has implications for some of the claims he makes in the theory and the theoretical structure. Mm-hmm. But anyway, let's move on. So the next, so we get at the end, balances recurrently form. We know they recurrently form because they do. Incidentally, they don't always recurrently form, but they do over time. The system tends that way. Balance of power politics predominates. And so his system's structural theory is structural realism, and it's balance of power realism, mm-hmm. right? He doesn't say that, but that's, now we finally clearly established that in chapter 6.
Yes.
128 pages into the book. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, we're supposed to put our arguments at the beginning and summarize them. Mm-hmm. Not so much here. So what did you think about the next chapter? This is structural causes and economic effects. There's actually some pretty interesting stuff going on in here.
There is. I mean, there's a fascinating discussion on the ambiguities of the term interdependence, which mm-hmm. is sort of entirely, like, could be just lifted out of the book.
Let's just summarize it. So this,
but summarizing the chapter,
this
itself,
article does like a couple different things. This article is at heart about polarity, mm-hmm. right? And it's about structural variation by the number of great powers.
Yep.
And so it's concerned with how do we measure the number of great powers, to which he is totally blasé. Because his point is just like, if I ask you what the great powers are, you're all going to pretty much come up with the same answer. This isn't that difficult.
Right.
And he used to do this exercise in his classes. He'd hand out and have you write down the five most important powers. And the point is that these were pretty much going to be the same. Maybe. Right. But that's also then a dig at the idea that you can clearly quantify this stuff too.
Well, but it's also a clear reflection of how much this is rooted in a particular and not always, well, ever in Walt's acknowledged perspective. Mm-hmm. There's a very particular place from which this book is written. There's this group that the common sense of which is, he presumes, shared by his readers.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a way that, who was it that said that one of the reasons why Walt's book becomes so successful is because in many ways it sums up things that are kind of commonsensical to a lot of various readers.
It provides a quote-unquote elegant explanation for something that a lot of people assume is true anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we skipped over something, or maybe we didn't. I don't know. We've had some whiskey and it's been a long time. But all the way back in page 80 and in chapter 5, this point he makes, we mentioned this, but we talked about it as if we're going to get to it, and then we went right by it, which is that this notion that for Waltz, structure is about relation and position, right? So he's drawing on S.F. Nadel here, who's actually also an important figure in the development of network analysis in some ways. At least that's what I remember being told when I took network theory. And he says that there's this ambiguity because relation can be used both to mean the interaction of units, which are definitely for him not structural, and the positions they occupy with respect to one another, which is structural.
Mm-hmm.
So you abstract at the level. So you can only have you're only at the level of structure when you have this sort of positional abstraction. In the number of great powers is a positional abstract. We don't know anything about who occupies those positions, but it is, you know, this is, you know, gets him just spending a lot of time explaining why this thing, which looks like a unit level attribute, how much national power a state has, is actually a structural variable, right? Mm-hmm. So,
and that makes sense.
Yeah,
it's a formal abstraction, and if we keep in mind exactly what the explanatory scope of the theory is supposed to be.
Yeah.
Theory is supposed to explain the recurrence of balances and the, what was the other, the socialization. The two things that he says that it's actually supposed to do in 124. Right, so balances recurrently form and states tend to emulate the successful policies of others.
Mm-hmm.
If that's what we're trying to explain, then in that sense, the number of great powers in the system, sure, isn't a unit level question. If we try to use that the structure of the system, bipolar, multipolar, how many poles there are in the system, to explain why any individual state does either of those things, then we've violated something, right? Then there's a problem, because then we would have to start talking about unit level attributes.
So, I mean, essentially, what then this chapter, this is a long chapter, but with this chapter, so having established questions of measurement, he then moves immediately to this idea. He starts to develop his argument that systems with smaller numbers of great powers are basically kind of better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the rough logic is if you had 1,000 equally powerful states, right, you know, everybody would be fighting one another all the time because there's just a lot of complexity in that system. So when you have a small number of great powers, they can manage the system. They don't have to be interdependent on one another in a way that might make them, you know, more likely to attack if another state does something because they're bigger, they have economies of scale, they can be autarkic, that is, they can fulfill most of their economic needs themselves if they need to. They can then take on roles as managers of the system because they have a stake in the system as it's currently oriented, because that system is what gives them power. So, you know, he runs through those, he really sort of starts to run through those arguments. He does have this argument now that I remember everybody always, you know, this was the go-to argument when we were in grad school in the 90s, where he really kind of critiques all the people who are going around in the 70s saying that the state is increasingly obsolete because there's economic interdependence, there's multinational corporations, and there are all these transnational actors around. And he says, you know, he rejects this in a bunch of reasons. He uses the standard example, which is that you had a lot of trade interdependence before World War One, a lot of monetary interdependence before World War One, and you still had a great war. So, you know, he at one point says this is like reading this literature, these people They might as well be writing at the turn of the century,
right?
It's a lot of kind of detailed argumentation about scarcity and why you don't have to worry so much about scarcity. I mean, it's mm-hmm. It's kind of like arguments we have now, right?
Mm-hmm. But again, what strikes me throughout this is moments where he doesn't do what I would have expected and mm-hmm. what I would like to have remembered that he did, but he doesn't. Mm-hmm. This chapter and the succeeding two chapters mm-hmm. are basically illustrative.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, here I have this theory that I have developed, and now I'm going to illustrate that theory with a series of different examples that I'm mm-hmm. able to find. And look, it turns out that the great powers are less economically interdependent than the non-great powers are, and therefore that counts as confirmation of my theory, mm-hmm. which is fascinating.
But then,
sort of,
but it's also then, right, this other, but it's doing dual work, because then yeah. that's also other art. It's also building towards this argument about bipolarity being
yes.
the most stable system, because you only have two great powers.
Right.
It's an issue with this book, right? Which is, and again, it's why even when it's not begging the question, it sometimes feels like it is.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's why I really understand now in retrospect why this is a hard book to read.
Mm-hmm.
It's because, you know, the organization is odd. Mm-hmm. So there is actually something in this chapter that I think is worth pointing out, because it gets at the way in which he's using this chapter to confirm both to things like interdependence are both a, for him, they're a logical implication of his argument,
mm-hmm.
but he's also using that to confirm his argument
yes.
by sort of drawing on these examples. And some of those aren't even kind of empirical arguments. They're like sort of counterfactual claims.
Yeah.
You know, the U.S. could do this.
Mm-hmm.
So he makes this argument that bipolarity, you know, so one of the reasons why bipolarity is better, remember, is that it actually reduces interdependence.
Right.
And when you're less interdependent, you're more secure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he says, look, Soviet Union, United States, not that economically interdependent.
Right.
Who can argue with that, right? I mean, and I sort of wrote down here, are they not, the question that arises, are the United States and the Soviet Union not interdependent because bipolarity has made them not interdependent? Or are they not interdependent because they're trying to push two different orders in
mm-hmm.
economic systems?
Right.
And I mean, heck if I know, right? I mean, in a sense, my inclination, given my priors, is to say that there's probably kind of both going on, right? But that primarily, you know, the fact that they're about different orders matters. You're looking skeptical.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to be generous, right? Mm-hmm. My basic position would be that it really matters that they're pushing two different kinds of order.
Mm-hmm.
But this does kind of raise an interesting issue, right? Because if he's right, then as China continues to rise, and as those if those military capabilities, or even if it stays where it is, because frankly the economy is bigger in PPP terms than the United States now,
mm-hmm.
right? If China really does make good on this indications that it will develop military capabilities commensurate with its economic strength, which would mean we would enter a bipolar system, militarily speaking. If he's right, then the kind of baby steps we're seeing towards economic decoupling by the Trump administration and by the Chinese also, kind of in response to tariffs and things like that,
mm-hmm.
that is a sign of where things will head,
mm-hmm.
right? That if he's right, bipolarity will mean that the United States and China will decouple, even though there might be efficiency losses,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
If he's wrong, and we look at things like just today, there's a Wall Street Journal story that said that the Department of Defense had overruled these sanctions against Huawei because they were worried that if their own contractors couldn't sell components to Huawei, they couldn't stay in business and they wouldn't be able to build
mm-hmm.
high-tech weaponry,
yeah.
right? Interdependence. If that's more like what the future is going to look like, then it is the order issue. Then it is
right.
really significant that we have, for the first time in, I don't know, a long time, right, a rival of the United States, or a potential rival of the United States, a power to rival that of the United States, whether or not it's actually rivalrous, that is that's highly integrated into the global economy,
mm-hmm.
right? And that would make the character of U.S.-Chinese relations really different than the Soviet Union. And that's sort of interesting, I think.
That is. I mean, I think I still have the hardest time that I have with this book is trying to figure out what it means to say that the structure of the system produces an effect. And so when, even with the story that you just told there, I would still look at that as different kinds of order projects, whether it's a global order or a national order.
Mm-hmm.
Arguably, the Trump administration's issue is that they've adopted a very anti-global very exclusive nativist nationalist way of framing what the United States' role in the world ought to be, and they're sort of proceeding like that. The consequence, and I think Waltz is very good on this, and this is how I would tend to read this, the consequence of stressing that kind of order project slash identity articulation as being the motor that drives these things is that you can't have something like what Waltz would call a systemic theory. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that's a great loss or as great a loss as Waltz would argue that it is, but I think he's absolutely right. If we are going to suggest that the important things in international affairs are produced by national state projects, transnational ideological and rhetorical coalitions, whatever you want to characterize them as, then by definition, we would not have anything like a systems theory. So, and I think that's something that we should probably, I don't know if we want to wrestle with it here, but it's something that I think that one should wrestle with when reading Waltz.
Another thing I want to point out is that what I found really interesting rereading this stuff, and it's sort of, you know, it's all this kind of like sort of relatively superficial, which is not a critique. He's running through a lot of stuff, kind of discussions of the economic situation in the 1970s and what that means for various arguments, is that what he's ultimately right. That one of the bottom line arguments he's making here is that not only is economic independence not pacifying, it's dangerous, right? Because it threatens state security, but also that economic interdependence is not going to usher in liberal utopia post-nationalism, right? Is essentially the very standard realist argument, right? But as he's making that argument, he has this interesting kind of point where he says, he's citing R.D. McKenzie from 1927, from about the middle of the 19th century, the quicker transmission of ideas resulted, in the words of R.D. McKenzie, in centralization of control and decentralization of operation. As he put it, the modern world is integrated through information collected and distributed from fixed centers of dominance. And then he likens this to the United States being kind of at a center of a bunch of industrial flows, right, and how that gives its power. Well, my colleague at Georgetown...
Here I meant to say Abe Newman, but instead I said his co-author, Henry Farrell. This is particularly embarrassing because Henry Farrell is not my colleague at Georgetown. He is at George Washington. And additionally, because Abe Newman has been a friend of mine since high school. So that's going on 30 years now.
Has this really cool article in this foreign affairs piece and this book that's going to come out, I hope eventually, with Henry Farrell on weaponized interdependence. And part of their argument is, you know, you get interdependence where there's centralized, there's a central node that you can control. and that gives you asymmetric power, right? And that's part of the kind of the power politics of interdependence. And, you know, okay, I sort of see it here. There are traces of all these things that kind of show up 40 years later.
That those things have to be understood as functions of the states in which they are located. Right? So this is this whole thing about how multinational corporations aren't actually multinational, but they're actually national corporations with global markets. So there's a way in which he doesn't want to say there are these nodes and it's control of these nodes that's important. The nodes are located in states and they make the states important.
Yeah, another thing, and I think we mentioned this beforehand, I don't think we mentioned it quite yet during the recording, that really struck me is because we still teach this theory, right? I mean, I just taught it the other day, but we always teach it really at the most abstract, simplified level. And because that, we have completely decontextualized it. And one of the things that's very clear reading this book is that it's very much a product of the 1970s. And we'll get to the second reason why it's a product of the 1970s, but here, one of the big reasons it's a product of the 1970s is that one of the things he's doing in these arguments is he's arguing that the United States is not becoming economically weaker, right? And that's important because, remember, 1970s are the collapse of the Bretton Woods system. A lot of people think that American economic hegemony is over, right, which is the dominant way people, a lot of people, I don't know if it's dominant, it's the way a lot of people are understanding things. There is a real sense that America is on the decline. And he's actually arguing against declinist narratives about the United States, which is really interesting. Then talking about how we predict these things before, the U.S. is staying power, it's really big, it's really wealthy. Look, just recently, he says, all these we swept the Nobel Prizes.
Yes.
We're so technologically capable. These arguments are mere images of arguments made now, mm-hmm. right, for why U.S. is bound to be unipolar, right, another, or it's going to take a lot longer than people think for China to give the U.S. a real run for its money. Mm-hmm. There's also the note I scratched down is that there's a, and there are a number of places where he basically says, smaller is better in terms of the number of great powers, and bipolarity is the smallest because you cannot have hegemony.
Right.
Right. Because the logic of his argument, up to a point, suggests that monopoly would be more stable than a duopoly if there isn't this balancing tendency that becomes overriding, which is the assumption here. Mm. And this is kind of Gilpin's critique. He says, you know, he says this is oligopoly theory, and oligopolies are just not as stable, right, as monopoly. Now in chapter 8, we're getting to the end, mm-hmm. And this is where he talks about structural causes and military effects, and this is the, if the last chapter was kind of the 1970s chapter about U.S. economic decline, this is kind of the chapter about detente and the Vietnam War.
Yes, absolutely. Right. Absolutely.
So what would you say the kind of crux of his argument in this chapter is?
We're continuing with the defense of bipolarity, mm-hmm. right? And so having a bipolar system reduces uncertainty. It allows for management of various kinds of military affairs. It also allows, he says on 175, the United States and the Soviet Union, like duopolis and other fields, are learning gradually how to cope with each other. So the idea, and he talks about mature bipolarity yeah. from time to time, right? So
which is detente.
Which is detente, exactly. Right. It's the idea that having consolidated their position relative to each other mm-hmm. and parenthetically relative to the rest of the world. So mm-hmm. because you have the bipolar system is, yes, it only has two great powers, but it does have all these other powers in it. They're just, mm-hmm. they're not important to the mm-hmm. system. So because there's no other sort of challenger, you have these two poles here. Mm. And if the poles just learn to deal with each other, then, he suggests, they can get along. You can have coexistence, you can have detente, you'll have low levels of interdependence, but that's fine because it actually allows for people to manage things on their own individual sides.
But there's a paradox here.
There
right?
is definitely, yeah. mm-hmm.
And the paradox is that he thinks that bipolar structures also incline the great powers to care too much about what's happening in the periphery, mm-hmm. to get involved in places like Vietnam, to think that everything right. is going to tip the balance of power, even though it obviously won't.
Right, right.
so it's kind of like we have to learn our way out of these structural dispositions.
Gee, isn't that impossible?
If we learn our way out of the structural dispositions, then we'll get the other half of the structural dispositions, and those are good.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's well aware of this. I mean, he's not like trying to hide anything
yeah.
here.
Yeah.
But it's
no.
really
no. For, was it 185? Force is least visible where power is most fully and adequately present. Mm. So you know, the Poles should learn that they're just powerful enough, and they should stop having to throw their weight around. They don't need recourse. They need what is it called? Non-recourse to force.
Yeah, and then he's right. back to the U.S. as a leading country. We're so powerful. Why do we worry about Vietnam? Why do we worry about these other things, right?
That we shouldn't. We should people not.
He heaps scorn on people who say, well, everybody else is growing faster. He's like, well, of course they're growing faster because
yep.
they were all destroyed in World War II.
Right.
We don't have to grow as fast, right? right?
And so we are where we are, and that's all there is to it.
You know, and other kinds of stuff. He also argues on page 181 that we've locked in a tech advantage,
yep.
or the great powers have, right?
Yes.
Because modern weaponry is so research intensive that you have to be really big to actually compete.
Mm-hmm.
And he's actually, the argument here is essentially that we've reached a point in human history where you need continental powers mm-hmm. if you're going to be great powers. And part of the reason why things are going to be stable is you only got two, the United States and the Soviet Union. There are no other continental powers. So, Europe could become one in theory, but you know, that's probably not going to happen for a bunch of reasons.
And it's firmly in the orbit of the United States.
Well, that's one of the reasons.
And that's one of the reasons why it's
right.
not going to.
Right.
And
so even though the U.S. might appear to push economic integration, at some point we'll kind of figure this out,
yep.
that this is bad for us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he also has these sort of interesting things to say about...
Well, we mentioned Vietnam. Yeah. The take on Vietnam is fascinating. 190-191.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? The international political insignificance of Vietnam can be understood only in terms of the world structure. America's failure in Vietnam was tolerable because neither success nor failure mattered much internationally. Right. I mean, I think the Vietnamese would probably beg to differ about that. But victory would not make the world one of American hegemony. Defeat would not make the world one of Russian hegemony. No matter what the outcome, the American-Russian duopoly would endure.
Mm-hmm. Except for we don't realize that, so we behave stupidly. Right. Right?
But if we did it right, then we would realize that, in fact, just sitting back and not getting involved, which is not dissimilar from Morgenthau's argument against Vietnam. Like, the U.S., this wasn't a vital national interest. The U.S. had no reason to be going in there. Mm-hmm. But it's a much softer critique of Vietnam than Morgenthau, certainly. Right.
He also actually talks about, you know, it's one thing to conquer another country, it's another to govern it. The problem in Vietnam was that we couldn't nation build, essentially. We couldn't we couldn't force government institutions. I mean, you know, just so you know, if you don't, Waltz was vehemently opposed to the Iraq War, right? And same argument. Doesn't affect our security. Bernie Sanders was talking about how two worst decision blunders were Vietnam and Iraq. And, you know, clearly, if you are old enough, this kind of looks the same, except for Vietnam is obviously much more costly in American lives because we weren't so good at standoff blowing up other people then. Right. So that's kind of chapter eight. The United States is doing just fine.
And it needs to relax.
Needs to relax. But this is, you know, this is going to be a little bit of a problem because structural pressures will cause us to tend to overestimate the importance of these peripheral conflicts and to get into these kinds of stupid crises. So, the management of international affairs, the last chapter in the book.
Only the powerful, only the great powers, and only really if there's just two of them, so if it's a bipolar system, are in a structural position that allows them to take responsibility for the management of the whole. So, you know, the argument here seems to be that if you are one of two poles, you have no disadvantage with, there's no collective action problem with you sort of doing things because so many things happen in the world that you would actually benefit from putting out the effort for them. And so you go ahead and do them. If you're a multipolar system, that's not going to work quite the same way because you're worried about coalition balancing against others and so on. The stability of bipolarity allows these firmly established states at the top to then take over at least take care of some of the common interests of the system. Now, it doesn't get his litany of what doesn't get addressed is I find fascinating. Bottom of 209, poverty, population, pollution, and proliferation. You know, military stalemate between the United States and the Soviet Union may permit those things to stay there for long periods. Who will deal with them? You know, and nobody.
And there are a couple of other interesting moments. So, like, on 199-200, he says that the United States has, like, two ways of justifying its actions abroad. And the first is we can exaggerate the Russian threat, as he puts it, and that's the domino theory of Vietnam. The second is we can engage in a grand crusade of world order building that... Yeah, he's not too big on that either. You know, he says it's kind of always what, like, big powerful states do, and it's, you know, always kind of self-interested. But he also says, you know, that he actually kind of says, you know, he also talks about how U.S. management hasn't been all bad, right? And, you know, the U.S. has done a lot of good things when it's been relaxed. It's fascinating to end this book on, you know, kind of detente rocks when a year later we're going to be entering the Second Cold War.
But there's an interesting tension right at the very end of the book because he says, okay, it's a bipolar system, but the U.S. is still the dominant power.
Right.
So there's a weird way in which, no, the United States is, economically, the United States is far and away the leading power. If the leading power does not lead, the others cannot follow. All nations may be in the same leaky world boat, but one of them wields the biggest dipper. Which is fascinating because if it's a bipolar system and we're supposed to be settling into it in the ways of detente, but then we're also supposed to be leading as the single pole that's going to take care of these things. There's a tension in there that
so
arguably some of the Second Cold War stuff is then about blowing that tension
up. So, I mean, look, this is a chronic problem, right? We actually sometimes do this without even blinking, right? We talk about the Cold War as, when we're talking particularly about the international economic order, talk about his U.S. hegemony. And then when we talk about it in, you know, then we go to realism, we're talking about his bipolarity. Well, which is it?
Yeah.
I mean, one answer, right, is that, well, in the economic sphere, it's U.S. hegemony, but in the military sphere, it's more disputed. But right. There's some tensions there, actually, with what hegemonic stability theory and hegemonic order theory would have suggest. It's the same thing with the UK, right? The UK is supposed to be the global hegemon in the 19th century, but in Europe, you know, it can't ever conquer Europe, right? That's not something it has the capability to do. It's it's one power amongst many.
Right.
And so there is this kind of tension, and there are ways of resolving it. One way of resolving it is just to do Gilpin, right? This is a power, you know, Woolforth and Schweller, or Schweller and Woolforth make this argument when they're trying to defend the idea that realism doesn't, like, go out with the Cold, you know, essentially the end of the Cold War collapse, Soviet Union doesn't, like, leave realism completely useless. What we're talking about are power transition dynamics, right? So that the United States is a global hegemon, which is being challenged by the Soviet Union, but the Soviet Union is never big enough, economically efficient enough,
right,
to really keep up.
It's that Rex Harrison argument.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you can make a sign of similar argument about the 19th century. You know, the power terms are closer.
Right.
Who's doing the power transition? That's going to kind of, maybe it's France for a while, then it becomes Germany, right? You know, but whatever. That's not really that. Then it's the United States, or maybe not.
Maybe
I don't
not.
Know.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that's certainly one way in which one could sort of try to resolve those tensions. Mm-hmm. There's another way to do it, which I kind of hinted at before, which is sort of abandon the idea of a system level and talk about these as practices of ordering.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could say there is a practice called bipolarity and there's a practice called hegemony.
Mm-hmm.
And we can look at those two as projects and see how those things and tensions between those kind of manifest themselves in particular cases. It would come, and I think Waltz is very clear, and I think he's absolutely right about this, it comes at the cost of a certain kind of international theory.
Mm-hmm.
There cannot be the kind of theory of international politics that Waltz would like us to have if we go down that road.
Mm. Well, as you know, one of my big issues with this book is that he thinks that you cannot treat interactions among units as structural because they cannot be positional. He says they're too ephemeral, basically.
Right.
But, you know, there are ways of, you know, standard network analysis, right, would say that that's structure, right? And we can get plenty of positional and relational analysis. And the fact that it's more dynamic, well, that's just an empirical issue.
Yeah.
Maybe it's dynamic. Uh-huh. Well, that means structural factors might be more dynamic, right? So there are lots of ways in which you can loosen these assumptions, in which you don't have to buy into that argument.
Right.
And I do think I have a kind of wrap up question in a second, but you know, I do think that, you know, the one of the things that it, besides the sort of some of the stuff we talked about, I mean, I do come out of this reminded of how important this book is to the trajectory of what happens in the 80s and the 90s in international relations theory, right?
Yeah.
Essentially, this becomes the argument to use as your straw man. And so everybody takes it and builds their own critiques off of it in, broadly speaking, even, you know, critical theory, right? I mean, critical theory, which should be the most divorced, is still arguing with this stuff, right?
Yeah.
And I don't want to speak for all the, I don't have any idea what a survey of critical theoretic literature in the period would look like, but I know that realism is a very consistent topic of criticism in Jim George's work and
Richard
Astley's work, you know, and Richard Astley's probably his best read piece is his critique of Waltz, right? And Ruggie, you know, his critiques of Waltz lead to an entire kind of new study of international change and state formation within IR, right? And constructivism is all about saying, hey, the early constructivists are very much about saying, you've got it wrong, right? You can have roles and norms and rules and structure, and agents can be much, we don't have to separate them out so much, right, to have better theories of how agency and structure interact. And so could all of that, you know, neoliberal institutionalism develops kind of as a critique of Waltz, and then ultimately just becomes open economy, you know, it sort of, you know, moves on into just doing its own thing. But there is a lot of ways in which, you know, it's hard to understand why people are doing what they're doing. I'm supposed to be doing this essay with Julian Goh for an International Political Sociology Handbook on relationalism.
Hey, I have a piece in that.
Yeah. The cool thing about this handbook is they're pairing IR people with non-IR people, or pairing IR people with IR people they don't agree with and seeing what happens. There's a way in which we were talking about the fact that a lot of the way we talk about international structure and international order is really Parsonsian.
Very.
Right? Norms, rules, institutions, right? It's sociological. I mean, to be more generous, it's sociological institutionalist, right? But it is very Parsonsian. We don't quite have pattern variables, but we come kind of close, right? And for him, as a kind of relational sociologist, this is just bizarre, right? Why are you, you know, for him, why are you hung up on these things, right? Why is everything, you know, norms against material factors, all that kind of stuff? And his answer is, you know, because you're still obsessed with realism, right? You know, you're still trying to argue with this approach, and particularly, I think, with structural realism and with the people who have continued structural realism on in various ways. So it's sort of, it accounts for these particular intellectual trajectories.
And it also accounts for, and with a chapter that I'm writing for that particular book with Charlotte Epstein, it accounts for the weird way in which mainstream Anglophone IR thinks about structure and equates structure with materiality in very strange ways. Mm. And even when then first wave constructivists start trying to talk about ideational structure of the international system or normative structure of the international system, it's still a structure that behaves very much like Waltz's structures are supposed to behave and is supposed to explain the same kinds of things. So there's a very interesting way, there's a legacy of this book, even for people who violently disagree with it. A lot of the analytical categories remain.
Right. There's a stylized version of this. You know, Waltz actually doesn't talk a lot about material stuff.
No.
You know, for him, these are just military capabilities, right? But there's a stylized explanation for this, which is that, so Theory of International Politics is doing a kind of very modified hodgepodge of structural functionalism and cybernetics and other kinds of systems theories. Mm-hmm. And in the 80s and 90s, some of the people who are blowing open constructivism, not all of them, basically are finding authors who they can deploy against Waltz. And what those authors, a lot of those authors are either social theorists who are critical of Parsons, or they're social theorists who are trying to reconstruct the Parsonsian project along non-functionalist better lines, Giddens, Archer, that sort of thing, or concerned with the, I think sociologists have to be concerned with these issues again, but they have to do it better and differently, right? And so we're sort of running these arguments from social theory against Waltz that are, because they sort of fit, they sort of, you can see how they line up, but they don't have a lot of attention to materiality the way that we tend to talk about in IR, right? They don't equate the same things with material that we equate with the IR. And I think a lot of what happens is that, it becomes ideas and essentially it becomes a culture. So this the old conception of the social and culture as being analytically distinctive, whether or not they should be, right? This kind of drops out, right? We wind up with all these sociocultural phrasings if you read that work. And, you know, actually part of Archer's argument is you can't conflate these things, right? But that means that we don't really appreciate until fairly recently that you can do relational and positional analysis without doing what Waltz is doing, right? I mean, and this is stylized. It's unfair to people. It's not really true that other people figured this, you know, other people figured this out earlier, but I think it does kind of track the overall arc of this kind of work, right? You know, we start getting into tools like either network analysis or the use of network analytics. We start getting into field theory, actor network theory. It's really the first time that you have a lot of people who are thinking in positional and relational terms in ways that are kind of weirdly in the same ballpark, right, as Waltz.
Right, but without the idea that you have to have those structural elements specified in a way that is universally constraining and produces absolutely uniform effects. So you end up with much more looseness in different structural components and how they might be able to combine and concatenate with each other. So, which is not something that would fit Waltz's very spare definition of theory, because as we started out at the very beginning of this conversation, everything for Waltz is ultimately tied back to these empirical generalizations, which are the laws, which are the only things that are out there to be explained. As opposed to, I mean, if he sort of hadn't made that move, if instead explanation were to be thought of as being about the explanation of particular kinds of outcomes in a counterfactual sense, why we got this one rather than that one, that opens up an entirely different realm methodologically where these different theoretical components can be combined in different sorts of ways. But that was never Waltz's target.
The other thing I think it's worth noting here, like we talked about constructivism, we talked a little bit about neoliberal institutionalism, which really doesn't really exist as such anymore. But the other obvious reason thing is that there are a lot of realists out there. There aren't as many as there are people who are working on different kinds of theories. In fact, most people don't even associate themselves with isms anymore. But, you know, it is, you know, if you want to understand what's going on in realism, right, you gotta understand Waltz to some degree. So a lot of neoclassical realism sort of is initially configured as a critique of Waltz, but as, you know, I think Stacey and I have shown and Brian Rathbun have shown, it really is just structural realism to some degree, right? Because you're basically the project looks at how shifts in relative power are sort of processed through domestic level factors to produce foreign policy. And that's very consistent with a Waltzian view, although he might be skeptical of how general those theories could ever be. Clearly, Mearsheimer has sort of displaced Waltz as a target for sort of big structural realist theory, but, you know, he's clearly kind of in dialogue with this approach. And as you pointed out, right, in the policymaking world, realism remains a kind of baseline language.
Right.
And people are aware of realist scholars. But maybe that's only because we continue to teach them. So it might be circular. So that's my question, right? I think we probably both agree that we will continue to talk about structural realist theory in our intro classes for a long time to come, right? That we're not gonna banish it. But should we assign this book? Would you assign this book? Do you assign this book?
I don't at the undergraduate level.
Yeah.
I mean, at the undergraduate level, I don't distinguish between flavors of realism. I assign Machiavelli, and we talk about basically Realpolitik. Mm-hmm. I'd introduce some language about polarity at a certain point, just to get them thinking about that. And frankly, we do that through the modified form of Risk that we play in class, where I do a bipolar and a bipolar world. I would assign it to...
I shouldn't have been dismissive of that. There are plenty of people who would probably find that more interesting than everything we talked about, but go on.
we could do a whole thing on diplomatic risk at some point.
Okay.
I would assign it to PhD students, but I would assign it to PhD students the same way that I would assign After Hegemony or Margaret Thauer Carr.
Mm-hmm.
Here is an important landmark in the internal history of the discipline. Mm-hmm. It is something that people argued with in Anglophone IR, largely conceived of as a subfield of political science in the United States. That group was dominated by this. Like this becomes a gateway through which all of this set of IR theorizing kind of passes. So whether one is agreeing with it or whether one is disagreeing with it. So I think it's important to make sense out of a lot of these debates. Is it important for making sense out of what's going on in international affairs? Well, let me just fall back on what you said before about the vocabulary, right? There is a way that these books provide terms that get recirculated and become part of this common vocabulary that we all end up using. Certainly Waltz coined a number of terms and phrases that remain in circulation. I think it's useful to sort of see where they originally came from. I mean, I'm not a Waltzian, either in the methodological sense of wanting a theory that does what Waltz says a theory should do, or in the theoretical sense of thinking that the polarity of the system is the single most important factor about how international affairs are structured. So I don't know that there's a lot of explanatory value. I think there's historical value here. The other thing that I think is fascinating about this is reading it to see how he makes the argument, where he could have made it less well, or he could have made it better, where he didn't do as good a job as he would have liked to. But in some of the ways that he sets things up, the study, the whole first six chapters that we just went through, and the fact that the argument kind of slowly emerges through what almost looks like a lit review, but it shows up. This is a very political theory style of writing. And that, seeing how he's able to do that, it's like, yeah, it's kind of foreshadowing, and it kind of pulls it out of these different critiques. And you arrive at a place like, oh, okay. But then turning around and saying, no, why do I find that compelling? Okay, well, let's examine the steps that he sort of went through to do this.
So sort of the rhetoric of theory.
The rhetoric of theory. I think there's something really interesting there about that. Mm-hmm. So, but those would be honestly the only reasons I would teach.
So we should close this out soon. But, when I announced that we were going to do this on Twitter, because that's the way I roll, you know, we got some pushback from some of our good friends, because that's the way they roll, right? And I got a little salty, because that's the way I roll. But the pushback was basically, you know, by even talking about Waltz and choosing as the first book for this, we're kind of reaffirming and solidifying a kind of intellectual history of the discipline, which is bad, right? Because it elevates this work, and this work is, in a lot of people's views, done damage. You know, it's done damage. Some people think that it took realism in the wrong direction. Even many realists now. You know, there's a subset of realists, Bill Wohlforth, who say we kind of should have been doing Gilpin, right? Mm-hmm. Not doing Waltz. So, I mean, there is something to be said for, like, you know, there's a self-fulfilling prophecy aspect of continuing to keep it on the canon. To me, that doesn't bother me, because I actually find, I mean, I don't know, again, if I would assign the whole book, but I actually find the theory intellectually interesting. It's not that I agree with any of it, but I think I find its architecture, right? And it's very explicit kind of scope, kind of fun to play with, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I get what you mean. There is something kind of compelling about that. I do think, though, that any real evaluation of this would have to come with a real appreciation of its blind spots, mm-hmm. and the limitations of the perspective. And as we've said throughout this conversation, the kinds of things that he appeals to as commonsensical, which are commonsensical among a certain group. And that's interesting that it's commonsensical among that group, but there are other kinds of common senses. There are other approaches. There are other ways of trying to cut into this material of international affairs or international politics, which he's not especially interested in doing. So for me, reading this as kind of a programmatic, logically purified statement of a certain point of view makes sense. But doing that suggests that there are others that then would need to be elaborated, and we need to sort of look at what those other things are. We got to make sure we don't lose sight of that. Okay, I agree. There is a danger of focusing too much on the canonical text. The only other thing I would say is this was a book that I think for both of us was kind of important when we were in grad school. It was important to our intellectual formation as IR people. Like, we cut our teeth reading it and going, bah, and writing at things against it. And I remember us having long arguments about this.
The story I told you is the story of us.
Yes, there we go. Surprise. No, but this is you know, it's a little self-indulgent for us to look back at some of these sort of things. But at the same time, right, we're writing what we know.
I want to say one thing, because I think I'm going to get in trouble. We've been so focused on kind of Waltz and realism that whenever I've talked about power transitions, I've mentioned Gilpin. Well, there is an entire older tradition of power called power transition theory, and people like Argansky and Kugler, people who Waltz goes after because they're doing statistics, and also because they think, you know, they think concentrated power is more stable, that single systems with single dominant powers are more stable. And that tradition, it's funny because that tradition, you know, basically by the time that the distinctions start to drop away, and, you know, in terms of the walls, they're making the same exact arguments. Just one of them comes out of political economy, and one of them comes out of peace science and related fields. So, okay, bottom line, we may have to split this into two episodes. We'll see what we do. But I certainly had fun. Maybe next time we do it later so we can have more scotch.
I think so. Good plan.
I think we are going to at least do one more episode. Mm-hmm. And I think we decided that next time we're going to do Cynthia Enloe's
Bananas, Peaches, and Bases.
Right.
So, which for me was a book that I read in undergrad, and was one of the first books that I read that sort of told me that studying international relations would actually be kind of a fun thing. Mm-hmm. So,
and our aim is to do this every 3 to 5 weeks, something like that. Yeah. But, you know, life can interfere. We're old and have responsibilities. So anyway, thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed it.
All right.